Candidates for Ohio governor have their running mates, and one of them now has the backing of current governor Mike DeWine. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, why the picks for lieutenant governor matter and the governor's endorsement. Then a man could face years in prison if he's convicted of smashing windows at Vice President J.D. Vance's house. Is the case about politics or mental health? Plus, a Wilmington Planning Commission has lots of questions about a proposed data center, but gets few answers. Joining me now to discuss the latest in the Ohio gubernatorial race are Cleveland Plain Dealer Chief Political Reporter Jeremy Pelzer and Signal Ohio Reporter Andrew Tobias. Welcome back, Jeremy and Andrew.
Thanks so much.
Andrew, the presumptive, as I mentioned, the presumptive Republican and Democratic nominees for Ohio governor announced their running mates this week. Let's start with Vivek Ramaswamy. Why did he say he picked Senate President Rob McCauley?
He was pretty explicit in saying that he felt that McCauley would help him navigate the state legislature. McCauley has been the leader of the Ohio Senate for a couple of years now, I think. It's pretty recent. But he's been there for about a decade. And so, in contrast, Ramaswamy has never held elected office before. He's not a government insider in Ohio. And so he wants to have somebody who can help him implement his policy agenda. He quoted at his event where he kind of like unveiled his decision, Thomas Edison, and the quote was something like, "A vision without execution is a hallucination," something along those lines. And so he feels that McCauley will help him do that. Kind of secondarily, one of my colleagues who was there in Cleveland spoke with somebody in the crowd who described how McCauley will bring balance to the ticket. And we asked him what he meant by that exactly. And he said that he liked the idea of having a devout Christian on the ballot, which McCauley identified himself that way. There were several speakers at the event in Cleveland that referred to Christian faith. And that's because Ramaswamy is a Hindu. And as people probably know, a major portion of the Republican electorate are evangelical Christians and with pretty conservative views on their faith. So I think that that was part of it, too. Even though, largely speaking, I don't know that voters are pulling, you know, or like casting their ballot based on the lieutenant governor. It's really more about what they can do to support the governor if they're elected. And so I think the most significant factor is his legislative experience.
Huh. Andrew, is this a job that McCauley had been auditioning for in any way?
I would say pretty explicitly, yes. I mean, he wasn't saying, pick me, you know, in public, but I know that he was appearing alongside him. He wrote an op-ed in the last week kind of defending Ramaswamy against some largely racist criticism because of his religious background. And McCauley has been term limited. He had been thinking about running for a congressional seat in Toledo. So he's been looking for his next position. And I think that this is something that him and his team were looking at for a long time, and they finally kind of closed the deal.
Mm. Well, Jeremy, Dr. Amy Acton picked David Pepper as her Democratic running mate. How did she explain her choice?
Yeah, it's interesting. As Andrew said, not a lot of voters are going to be basing their vote for governor off of the choice of lieutenant governor. But it's really interesting. One of the things that's important about these choices is what it reveals about the candidates, both their values and also what they think their potential vulnerabilities are. So in the case of Amy Acton, picking David Pepper, who's a former state party chair for the Democratic Party, as well as a former Hamilton County commissioner and Cincinnati City Council member. He also ran for attorney general and got his butt handed to him in 2014 by now Governor Mike DeWine. What Democrats say that he brings to the ticket is, one, he can raise a lot of money. He has a lot of connections, both within the state and around the country, especially from wealthy pro-democracy activists. And so he can bring in money to help the Acton ticket against Vivek Ramaswamy, who's a billionaire in his own right and has been raising a record amount of money. And then also, they see him as an attack dog, that he can really be the one who can take it to the Ramaswamy-McCauley ticket, while Amy Acton, who's more comfortable being more seen as the compassionate type and not bad cop, then they can have sort of that good cop, bad cop routine that many tickets have.
Jeremy, you mentioned fundraising. How's fundraising going for both candidates? Ramaswamy's been doing very well, right?
He has. He actually just came out. We're not going to know exactly until campaign finance reports come out at the end of the month. However, Ramaswamy on his own announced that he's raised another $9 million. That's on top of another $9 million that he raised during the first half of 2025. I mean, that's a lot of money this early in the cycle. And we're going to see money not only from his own campaign, if this becomes a race, a competitive race, we're going to see a lot of outside money come in as well.
Any idea how much Dr. Amy Acton has raised?
She is not on her own, said. She's been doing pretty well, especially for a Democrat. She's raised, I believe, a few million dollars as of the first half of the year. I mean, she declared even before Ramaswamy did, so she's been hitting the road fundraising. So she's been doing pretty well, and I think at least the expectation is that David Pepper will help them really kick it into gear in terms of raising money to compete.
Andrew, you both have mentioned that, you know, people don't typically cast their vote for governor based on who the lieutenant governor is. What does Ohio's lieutenant governor do?
It's largely a ceremonial role, similar to the vice president office, where it's somebody who appears in the ballot. There's kind of like a rollout. People generally kind of hear their names. They are, you know, an elected official. They're on the inside. They're in the meetings and stuff like that. But it doesn't have, you know, a lot of official responsibility. What we've seen in the past is that typically an Ohio governor will choose a state agency for their lieutenant governor to run. And then, you know, from there, it's kind of what they make of it. So we saw when John Husted became Mike DeWine's lieutenant governor in 2019, DeWine put him in charge of, he actually created a new state agency that kind of housed a lot of Husted's pet projects in terms of modernizing government and things like that. But he also had a big say over making appointments to Jobs Ohio, which is the state's private economic development arm. And then eventually he appointed him to the U.S. Senate, which kind of shows how being lieutenant governor can be a springboard to other offices down the road. DeWine himself was the lieutenant governor in the early 90s. So it's not a nothing job. You know, Husted is, you know, was an advisor to the governor, and he's kind of like in the meetings and stuff like that. But the governor really has the authority to make decisions, and what the lieutenant governor ultimately does kind of just depends on who they are and kind of almost like what the governor lets them do.
Jeremy, we've been talking about Vivek Ramaswamy and Dr. Amy Acton. Will either of them face competition in the primary?
Both technically will. It's likely that, or it seems that other people at least are challenging both of them. However, it remains to be seen if any viable candidates will come out. Perhaps the most likely to be a viable opponent to either of them would be Casey Pusch, who's a YouTuber and a car guy from Northwest Ohio. He's running to Ramaswamy's right, running more on Christian nationalism, and he's been very active on social media. We'll see how much of a viable challenge he brings to Ramaswamy. On Acton's side, her biggest potential opponent was Tim Ryan, of course, the former congressman and presidential candidate who now lives outside of Columbus. He opted not to run. And so I think it's fair to say that Acton at this point is the presumptive nominee.
Okay. Well, Governor Mike DeWine, who of course can't run again because of term limits, finally endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy. Were either of you surprised by how long that took?
Yeah, go ahead, Jeremy. You can take it.
I think DeWine, he told reporters last month that he was holding off because he wanted to talk to Ramaswamy about issues, and you know whether that means he was holding off because he wanted to get some sort of assurances from Ramaswamy. He didn't really make that clear. I think part of his decision, I'm sure it played into it about the timing, was one, he wanted to see who the lieutenant governor candidate for Ramaswamy would be, whether it would be McCauley, who he's had a good relationship with, or possibly former treasurer Josh Mandel, who he's not as had a little bit of a rockier relationship with in the past. And then also David Pepper, as I said, ran against DeWine in 2014, and there was no love lost between the two of them. That was a brutal campaign where there was a lot of attacks that Pepper and DeWine launched at each other. And DeWine, I am sure, does not recall fondly David Pepper's attacks against him.
Hmm. Anything you want to add to that, Andrew?
Yeah, and I am just speculating here, but I noticed that during Wamiswamy's campaign speech on Wednesday night after he announced his lieutenant governor pick, he referenced how if he's elected governor, he wants to continue Ohio's Science of Reading initiative, which refers to really changing how kids are taught to read at a young age. DeWine has been spending a lot of attention trying to change Ohio towards a science of reading state. He's citing an example of Mississippi, which saw its reading scores just dramatically improve when they did that as kind of the first state to really kind of, it's like the, you know, the key example of it. But it took a long time. It took like 10 years for Mississippi to kind of fully execute that. And so I think DeWine would probably understand that Ramaswamy will see things different than him. But I think it would be, yeah, I could see him wanting to get some kind of reassurance about something like that, that Ramaswamy doesn't just totally pull the plug on something that's important to him. So I imagine that was something they talked about.
Interesting. Well, Jeremy, you mentioned the tough campaign between now Governor DeWine and David Pepper, who's going to be Dr. Amy Acton's running mate. But Governor DeWine also has kind of defended Amy Acton in the past few months, right? I mean, she's facing a lot of criticism about the state's handling of the COVID pandemic. She, of course, was very close to Governor DeWine at that time.
Governor DeWine told reporters last month when he was asked about this, in fact, I believe it was Andrew who asked him about it, and he said at the time that the buck stops with him, that the coronavirus orders that came out were issued by him, and that he has responsibility for them, not Amy Acton, or not for that matter, John Husted, who's now running for U.S. Senate later this year. And the governor, that's not the first time the governor has said that, but it also absolves Acton of responsibility in a way. So I don't think there was any question that DeWine was going to not endorse Acton over the Republican nominee. DeWine is too much of a staunch Republican to do that. And also, he and Ramaswamy haven't had the closest relationship, too. But at the same time, he is not going to go out of his way to now trash Amy Acton in the press. I don't think that's his way. I think Amy Acton and him worked very closely together. And, you know, I don't think she was disloyal, and he rewards loyalty with loyalty.
Hmm. Andrew, what do you think the big issues are going to be in this gubernatorial race?
I think education is really going to be a focus for both candidates. Ramaswamy has made a real point of talking about his desire to implement what's called kind of merit pay for teachers, which basically the way that he would describe it is making sure that teachers are paid more for doing, you know, for teaching kids well. That becomes very controversial quickly because the question is always, how do you evaluate teachers and know which ones are good and which ones are bad, and how many perhaps just is kind of dependent on the environment of the community they're in or the kids that are there, or just many other number of factors that people can imagine what it might be like for somebody in a classroom. So, and then, you know, he's talked about expanding school choice, which basically means creating more government money for private schools. And Acton's campaigned on, you know, it's a really key message for Democrats in general, which is increasing funding for schools. The state has not fully implemented the formula that they passed in 2019 that was meant to address longstanding issues of how much the state is paying for public education versus what local taxpayers have to bear through their property taxes. And the budget that the state recently passed increased funding, but not as much as it would have been had they fully funded the formula. So that's just one area. I mean, I could see, you know, they're going to be talking about quote unquote affordability and basically what the government can do to help people pay less or, you know, be able to afford their lifestyles more. You know, Acton at her first campaign event referenced maybe having a program to give a down payment assistance to first-time homebuyers. So those are a couple of things. I think a lot of it too is probably going to be pretty national, you know, kind of like what Republicans and Democrats talk about when it comes to like crime. When, you know, I know that Acton's talking about some of the corruption scandals that have happened in state government. So it kind of is going to run a lot of ground. But I think education especially is going to be important to both of them.
Yeah. Anything you want to add there, Jeremy?
I think like a lot of races these days, even top of the ticket races like governor, so much of it is based on people's feeling about the national mood. And obviously, Donald Trump will be an issue in this race. You know, national issues will be an issue in this race, even though Ohio's governor doesn't really have control over things like, say, Venezuela. I think people's feelings about the Republican and Democratic parties, especially in an era where so many people cast their vote in opposition to the other party as opposed to support for their own party, are going to play a role. And it's going to be up to Ramaswamy and Acton to give voters a reason to vote for them as opposed to voting against the other person.
Well, speaking of Acton and Ramaswamy, I know in Ohio, the lieutenant governor candidates typically don't debate directly, but if they did, which debate do you all think would be spicier, Ramaswamy versus Acton or McCulley versus Pepper?
So I think that there's sort of the good cop, bad cop. I mean, Ramaswamy is, I think, kind of does it all with a smile, but I'd say he's like the spicier debater between him probably and Amy Acton. And then Pepper is certainly, you know, more of a kind of fiery personality than McCauley is. So I guess I'll split the difference. It just kind of depends on, you know, which candidate you're talking about.
There you go. What do you think, Jeremy?
I think Andrew's right. I think Amy Acton's come a long way on the campaign trail and she can definitely hold a room. I think Vivek is definitely able to hold a room. And I'm looking forward to it. And if there's an LG debate, I think that would be really good political watching as well.
Hmm. Well, with their running mates announced, what are you both watching for next with these candidates? I'll start with you, Andrew.
Yeah, the campaign finance reports, like Jeremy said, are due at the end of the month. So we'll see with Ramaswamy. He's raised a ton of money. How much of it might be coming from out of state? You know, governor candidates, Republican governor candidates, Ohio have no trouble raising money because I think kind of the smart money, you know, if you're betting, that's who people think is going to win. And that has a way of just attracting more contributions. But Ramaswamy has a national profile. And I think there he has just kind of fans from following his career from when he started running for president a few years ago. And then I think for Acton, the question will just be whether she can raise enough money to be, you know, competitive. I think it's just kind of a given that Ramaswamy will have more. And I think that it's almost like overstated that just having tons and tons of money is gonna, you know, I think there's like diminishing returns at some point where you just, if you have $100 million or if you have like 40 or 50, it kind of stops paying off in the same way. But you do have to have enough money to let voters know who you are. And so if she's able to be competitive, I think that's, you know, I don't know what that number would look like, but it's more, it's not can she raise more money, but can she raise enough just to make sure that she's, you know, hangs in there and that she can, you know, get her name out there.
And what I'm waiting for is the reason they're all raising all this money is because they're going to spend most of it on television ads. And in any political campaign like this, there's usually a tipping point where you spend the first early days of your campaign raising money, and then sort of the seesaw goes to the other side, and then you start spending all of it. And these are two candidates who have not held political office before, not run for statewide office before. And so it's really a chance for them to both define themselves and each other. And it's coming. This is the calm before the storm, before all of us just get a barrage of TV ads, probably a lot of them attack ads, coming into our homes.
Okay, so brace for impact. Well, I've been talking with Cleveland Plain Dealer Chief Political Reporter Jeremy Pelzer and Signal Ohio Reporter Andrew Tobias. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, a man smashes windows at Vice President J.D. Vance's house. Is the case about politics or mental health? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A Hyde Park man is accused of smashing windows at Vice President J.D. Vance's house, causing thousands of dollars in damage. Joining me now to discuss the case is Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Quinlan Bentley. Thanks for being here, Quinlan.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
Quinlan, walk us through the vandalism that occurred at the Vice President's Cincinnati home. What happened and when did it happen?
Yeah, so shortly after midnight on Monday, at least according to federal prosecutors, William DeFore was seen running basically along the fence line of the vice president's house, and he entered the property through the driveway. They say he used a hammer to try to smash a Secret Service vehicle. A Secret Service agent identified herself and told DeFore to drop the hammer. But he didn't comply with those commands and continued to the house and smashed 14 window panels, including what the government called enhanced security assets on those windows, valued at over $28,000. Eventually, he dropped the hammer in front of the front porch, and they say he was stopped by Secret Service and then arrested by Cincinnati police. All this happened not long after the vice president had departed from a weekend trip to Cincinnati. He left, I think, the day before in the afternoon. That was kind of a heightened situation as far as the police response and you know, the news coverage of this afterward.
Oh, sure. So the vice president and his family were not home at the time of all this happened.
No, the house was unoccupied, and they had returned to D.C. by the time this had happened, or were on their way to D.C. So they were not home when this occurred.
Okay. You said that the damage to these windows because of these enhanced security assets was more than $28,000. What kind of charges does this person face?
Yeah, so they face numerous charges, both in federal and state court. The federal charges are much serious, and the penalties are quite a bit steeper than what the state court charges are. But essentially, they're charged with damaging government property, engaging in physical violence in a restricted building or grounds, and resisting or impeding federal officers. And now those charges carry a total possible sentence of 40 years in prison, whereas the state charges, the most serious of which is felony vandalism, carries, you know, up to a maximum of a year in jail or in some other correctional facility. So the federal case is obviously a lot more serious than what the state case is.
Sure. And this might be a dumb question, but why both state and federal charges?
Yeah, so it speaks to different crimes. With the state, it's more about, you know, the act of vandalism, you know, criminal damaging is one of the charges. You know, I mean, there are different statutes in the state law and in the federal law. Obviously, you know, the state law is not going to have anything about resisting federal officers or breaking federal government property. So those fall under two different jurisdictions is essentially the easiest way to answer that question.
That makes sense. So does this person who's been charged have a criminal record, a previous criminal record?
Yes. So there are, we found two previous criminal cases in Hamilton County. One was in 2023, I believe. And that case, the charges, basically they were found mentally incompetent to stand trial and they weren't restorable, meaning that they wouldn't have benefited from treatment that would have allowed them to resume their criminal case. That case was dismissed. And then there was a 2024 vandalism involving a business in Hyde Park. And that case ended in a order for conviction in lieu of treatment, which is essentially means that if DeFore completed his court-ordered treatment program and followed all the conditions of that, that the case would be dismissed. So there were definitely mental health implications in both of those cases. Mm.
So does it appear that this incident with Vice President Vance's home was politically motivated in any way?
So far, there's been no evidence brought forward by prosecutors or police to suggest that it was politically motivated. At an arraignment the day after this incident, Mr. DeFore's attorney, Paul Loftman, said essentially that this is a purely a mental health issue. He said that he and his client went over Mr. DeFore's writings, including some poetry, to try to see if there was a political motive at all, and that basically none was found by the federal government. You know, they haven't specified exactly what mental health issues or challenges that Mr. DeFore is facing, but that's their defense. And so far, there hasn't been any evidence, like I said, that this was politically motivated. Actually, Mr. Loftman said he's not even sure if Mr. DeFore knew that this was the vice president's house that he was vandalizing. So, but obviously the vice president has made statements in response to this, and there's been a wide variety of national news coverage about this as well. So,
sure. Well, what has Mr. DeFore's family said about all this? Have you heard from either of his parents?
Yes. So Catherine DeFore, his mom, spoke. She gave a brief statement outside the federal courthouse this week. And she didn't go much into detail, but she essentially said that, her son was she described him as a scholar, a straight A student. She said he had a full ride scholarship to study music. But that he has mental health challenges and that those issues have kind of consumed his life. She said, her family is grieving. There's a lot of stress, obviously, with these serious charges that were filed. But she also, empathized with the vice president's family, essentially saying that she understands it's difficult to raise children in the public eye. So it doesn't appear, at least from her statement, that she's resentful toward the government or to Vice President Vance over these charges. But she did highlight the mental health issues as something her family's been grappling with for a while and cited that as basically the reason for these charges.
Hmm. You mentioned that the vice president has responded to this. What has he said about all this?
Yeah, so he posted a statement on social media, essentially calling Mr. DeFore a crazy person who was wielding a hammer and attacked his home. The statement didn't really go much beyond that, other than him basically asking the media to respect his family's privacy and to avoid posting photos of his house online. There have been protests outside his home in the past. The government in the court documents it's filed, didn't identify where the vice president lives, but it's not exactly a secret in Cincinnati. So, essentially the main statement was that Vance described Mr. DeFore as a crazy person. Hmm.
What's next with this case? What are the things you're going to be watching?
Yeah. So, At the federal arraignment, Mr. DeFore was ordered to temporary detention pending a full detention hearing that is actually happening this afternoon at 1:30. My colleague Kevin Grasha will be there to inform people of the outcome of that hearing. But essentially what they're trying to decide is whether the evidence shows that Mr. DeFore is in any kind of danger to the community or any kind of flight risk, and whether he should be held or incarcerated for the remainder of his case, or whether he can be released on bond and be trusted to return to court on his own or with his family's help or what have you. So that's kind of the next step. But these kind of prosecutions can take months, so it'll likely be quite some time before we see any kind of resolution in this case.
Well, we know you'll continue to follow it, and we appreciate your talking with us about it today. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Quinlan Bentley. Thanks so much for your time today, Quinlan.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Up next, a local planning commission puts the brakes on a proposed data center. We hear why. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Neighbors in Wilmington have questions about a proposal to build an Amazon data center there, but Amazon representatives didn't have many answers at a recent Planning Commission meeting. Joining me now to discuss the status of the project is WCPO 9 reporter Jay Shakur. Welcome back, Jay.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. But I know you've done a lot of reporting on this data center. Before we get to that, I do want to ask you about this awful crime that occurred just about a week ago now. An 11-year-old girl was shot and killed in the West End on New Year's Day. Tell us about this little girl and what happened.
Definitely. From what we know, Queen Avery Reed, 11-year-old, was playing at Laurel Park, as you mentioned, in the West End when she was shot and killed. Believe she was pronounced dead once she was transported to the hospital. Don't know who did it. Authorities are actively searching for any suspects or any information in this case. The ATF has gotten involved, and it's caused a great uproar, a lot of outrage, particularly about technology used to catch suspects like this. It's now going on a week now. over a week almost that this shooting happened.
Well, and you mentioned this was at a playground. I mean, what time was it? What were the kids doing there? Just being kids?
Yeah, they were just being kids. It was around 5. We know it gets darker earlier now because it's winter, but it was around 5. So in terms of timing, actual time, it was a bit earlier. It wasn't, you know, late at night. But kids were playing. Some people in the neighborhood say that they were making, you know, TikToks at the park, you know. So, you know, being what kids and doing what kids do, rather, in this day and age, when this all happened around 5 in the afternoon.
Well, I know members of the community addressed Cincinnati City Council on Wednesday. What did they have to say to council members?
A lot of upset questions about the city's deployment, pacing, and planning when deploying certain resources like cameras, police cameras, and really calling on city council to do more proactively. There was, after the fact, a camera, police camera placed directly in this park, Laurel Park in the West End, after the shooting. Residents say, you know, that was a little too late. It was a lot of anger and questions surrounding that in particular at council.
Well, here's Isaac Davis.
When are you going to do something for the community? You have all this money and the cameras are not up. It takes for another child to get killed for you to roll a camera in there.
So how many cameras does the police department have in the West End, and are there plans for more?
Yes. So according to City Manager Cheryl Long, there were 6 operational cameras in the West End during the time of the shooting. Did they catch anything? We don't know. Obviously, that would be part of the investigation. And the city says that it's priority now for CPD to place 6 more in the next 30 days in the West End. Presumably, all of that is coming from $150,000 that was set aside last year in September, a part of a $5.4 million public safety package that the council passed. So more coming, according to City Manager Cheryl Long, but 6 were already there. Did they catch anything? Did they see that those cameras record anything? We as of now, don't know.
Did you get an opportunity to hear from any neighbors in the West End about what the city manager said about more cameras being on the way? I guess I wonder how they're responding to that and if they want to see even more happen. I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to them about that.
Yeah, a lot of community members are saying, you know, that's a good thing. Bring all the resources you can to the West End, but really expand that citywide. So they're encouraging that, but they want to see it done, you know, more quickly. They want to see it done more, they feel, more efficiently. And they want to see a lot of more resources permanently put there. You know, the camera currently put up at the park, it's a temporary thing. You know, it's one of those mobile cameras that with wheels that can move, one of those trailers. So they want more permanent fixes. If it is cameras, they want those there permanently, year round, around the clock. So they're encouraging it. They're excited. They're warm to it, but they're saying, you know, it shouldn't have taken, you know, that's been the big sentiment. It shouldn't have taken this death to do that. Isaac Davis, who just heard from him, his son, Dominic Davis, was shot near this park just 2-3 years ago, in 2023. And they were calling for cameras then. So it's been this round robin of do something now, not just the West End, but more across the board, across the city, in all playgrounds, really.
Is there anything more we know about the investigation, the search for the shooter? I mean, has there been any more information about that at this point? You mentioned it's been a little more than a week now since this happened.
No information, at least publicly, that we know has been shared with authorities. Again, the ATF has a reward. They still have an open reward for any information on the Dominic Davis shooting that happened in 2023. They're now involved in this, asking for any information, but still no identification on suspects in this tragedy, this New Year's Day tragedy.
Mm. Well, I appreciate that information about that case. I do want to turn now to data centers. Data centers have been a major point in contention around the country. Ohio is a hot spot for them. Tell us about this Amazon data center proposed for Wilmington. How long has this been in the works?
We don't exactly know how long it's been in the works. We do know when it became a big public outcry from those in Wilmington, Ohio. It started about November, when residents say they got wind this was happening. It's a $4 billion project by AWS, Amazon Web Services, supposed to provide at least 100 permanent jobs in that area. It's what Amazon is saying. But that's when it really became public, when certain approvals were already making their way through the local government there, when residents really knew what was happening, where it would be. And that's when questions start coming, like, why is this happening? Is this going to be safe for us environmentally? And why wasn't I, talked to several people that live in the area, why wasn't I aware of this at all happening literally in some people's backyard?
Yeah, you meant, I think you said $4 billion data center employing as many as 100 people permanently. Do you know anything, or can you tell us about the footprint, just how big this thing would be, how much space it would take up?
In terms of the space, it would take up about 471 acres right off of US 68. As you get really into Wilmington, there have buildings, there'll be substations there, a lot of different infrastructure upgrades there, but about 471 acres. Right behind it is the Timber Glen subdivision. So right behind it are homes.
Wow. What kind of questions? There was, I know the Wilmington Planning Commission considered this or was talking about this earlier this week. What kind of questions did the Planning Commission have for the Amazon representatives who were there?
The questions are really centered around environmental impact. You know, in terms of from, you know, I'm not an expert on these data centers, but from what I understand, they use a lot of energy, a lot of water for what they do. And a lot of the questions are surrounding, you know, what chemicals are you using in this water? Is the water going to flow back into our sewer system? And so the environmental impacts was the big focus for many of the commissioners there that asked Amazon representatives questions. That was some of the questions from residents. What will be the environmental impacts? And Amazon, surprised a lot of residents, did not have a lot of answers. The common refrain was, we'll have to get back to you on that.
Wow. Did they have any answers to these questions, or was it just kind of constantly, we'll get back to you, we'll get back to you?
For those particular questions, it was constantly, we have to get back to you. They may have said, you know, that's proprietary information, we can't share it, you know, because that's a business secret. But other than that, a lot of the answers as it concerns the environmental impact and the long-term impact, that was the common answer from the Amazon representatives.
What was the reaction from commissioners and from the residents who were there when these Amazon representatives kept saying, you know, either we can't tell you that or we'll get back to you?
You could hear a gasp every time that Amazon representatives said, we have to get back to you, because the meeting was to essentially get into the nitty gritty, the details of impact, to kind of, you know, it appears it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when, and the impact it's going to have when it happens and when it's built. And so that was the point of the meeting. And so there was audible gasps from the packed meeting room in Wilmington. But also the commissioners, you know, eventually decided, you know what, let's table this. What that means, we don't know when they will bring it back, what that will look like. But essentially, commissioners say, you know what, let's table this until we can get more answers publicly and privately on these long-term impacts.
Well, as you said, several residents spoke out at the meeting.
I don't care if it's proprietary or not. I'm a project manager. I read prints. I do construction. I know it's there. They have the information. We deserve to know what it is, if it's going to have an impact on people's homes and their lives.
We want to know, like, what the cooling mechanism is going to be, what type of generators will be used, what are the impacts expected to traffic in and around the county.
Jay, did those comments we just heard, were those reflective of a lot of what you heard at that meeting?
Definitely. Definitely. It was a lot of, you know, what would this mean for me and my family? I get this may bring, you know, some economic incentive to Amazon as well as Wilmington, Ohio at large, but what would this mean for my family? That last soundbite there was from Jessica Sharp. She lives about 200 feet away. She just bought the property, started to build her first home with her young family, and found out this was coming. And she was saying, you know, I'm going to be 200 feet away from this thing. What is the impact going to be to my family? I didn't sign up for having this massive industrial commercial facility literally in my backyard. So that was the sentiment of literally everybody there. You had all ages. I've seen kids speak at the podium. I've seen middle-aged people speak. I've seen seniors speak. It's a wide range of people there in Wilmington speaking out against this, or at the very least asking, hey, we need more questions answered.
Well, now there's a Facebook group opposed to the proposal. Did Jessica Sharp start that?
Yes, she started a Facebook group It has about 3,000 members, and it really details everything. It gives tons of information about, you know, it tracks all the documentation that's publicly available that you can, you know, get from Wilmington, Ohio. But she started this group, and it has gained traction. That's how a lot of residents say they have gotten information about this data center. It's called Wilmington Residents for Responsible Development. And their big axe is, hey, if we can't stop it, at least let's do it as is in the name. Let's do it responsibly.
Huh. And did they say whether they've had any kind of direct conversation or tried to have any direct conversation with Amazon, or they seem to try to be working through these public meetings?
They haven't had, from my knowledge, any direct conversation with Amazon. They've tried to push for that direct conversation. On their own, they do hold town halls, and they invite and encourage and want, they say, Amazon to be there. Commissioners do show up. Planning commissioners do show up. City council members do show up. But they essentially hold town halls hoping that Amazon will show up and have answers outside of the public meetings held by the city government. The next one is January 12th at 5:30. On this particular issue held by this Facebook group started by Jessica Sharp.
Hmm. So you mentioned that the Wilmington Planning Commission tabled this. Was this a unanimous vote? What kind of commentary was that when they decided to essentially kind of, you know, put the brakes on this decision?
Yeah, it was a unanimous vote to table it, to get more information. There was, again, that commentary from one of the commissioners saying, hey, there are a lot of questions that we want answered, a lot of questions that the public want answered, and we need time to get that information. It wasn't more so like, we don't want to do this project. It was more so, hey, this project is happening, but we need to have more information disclosed publicly before we, you know, sign up for the final deal.
And have they said anything about when they might reconsider this or any kind of time frame?
No information publicly about what's next. I reached out to city government there to get answers on that. We do know, again, citizens on their own will be having town halls, having public discussion on that front about you know, asking questions. But in terms of the official government bodies, either the City Planning Commission or the City Council, we don't know when it would go before commission again, assuming it would be based on, you know, the deadline for certain approvals and things like that. Assuming it will be within the next couple of months that it's brought up again. And even then, when it's brought up, we don't know what obviously the action would be.
Sure. How long have you been following this project, Jay? This was not your first meeting in Wilmington, right?
No, I've been to Wilmington covering this 3 or 4 times now. We started getting tips in our newsroom around that time, October, November, when residents say they first publicly knew about it. And they only knew about it because of a school board meeting that had to approve certain land use things. That's how they knew about it. That's how they got wind of it, because of that. And so from there, we started getting tips, start calling, started trying to get in contact with the Port Authority and things like that. And then they finally had a first meeting in, I believe, late November. And that's when we first started covering. So it's been a few months now that we've been covering this, multiple meetings, and every meeting I've been to is packed. Wilmington City Council chambers, they aren't big, but the room is packed. At least 100 people in a room that probably sits 25, 30, maybe at the most 40.
Oh my goodness. Well, and you said you've seen, you know, little kids testify or give, you know, comments and people of all ages. And this Facebook group with 3,000 people, that seems like a big Facebook group anywhere, but Wilmington's not that big a place, is it?
No, it's not that big of a place at all. It's one of those places where everyone knows of or knows everybody. Everyone's, you know, they told me themselves, they see themselves as a big family. So to have 3,000 people, most of them, from my understanding, living in and around Wilmington, chiming in, even supporters and people who in Trenton, Ohio, are coming in and trying to boost the numbers and show that, hey, this is bigger than just Wilmington. It's a large undertaking just to start as literally a grassroots, hey, this is happening. Did you know it's happening? here's a centralized location for all that information. Definitely a big, big undertaking.
Well, we appreciate your sharing this information for us. We know you'll keep covering this. I've been talking with WCPO9 reporter Jay Shakur. Thank you so much for your time today, Jay.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And you will want to tune in to Cincinnati Edition on Monday. For our entire hour on Monday, we're going to have Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purval and Covington Mayor Ron Washington on the show together. We're going to ask them about their top priorities and discuss the Brent Spence Bridge Corridor Project. Mark your calendars. You won't want to miss that. And we will, of course, be able to take your questions. You can either call or email on Monday. And while you're marking your calendars, be sure to mark your calendar for January 29th. We've got a pet show coming up that day. We'll have a live studio audience, but they won't be in the studio. They'll be here in our building. We've got room for plenty of people, but you need to RSVP at wvxu.org. You can check there. We're even talking about getting some pets in the audience. Can't bring your pets, but we will have some pets from a local shelter. We'll have our experts there to answer your questions about your favorite furry friends. So get on the website now, wvxu.org. Look for the cute picture of some dogs and a cat and sign up to be in the audience for that pet show. You won't want to miss it. It's going to be loads of fun. Those pets we're planning to have in the audience, maybe you're looking for a new furry friend. Maybe you could adopt one. So mark your calendar. January 29th is the pet show. And you have been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. And Rob Fetters composed our theme music. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening and have a great weekend.